Hi, everybody. My name is Emily. I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hi, Emily.
And I wanted to have props really badly, but I don't have any. I haven't let people take pictures of me for about 10 years, so I don't have any pictures to show you. Also, I'm still on my journey, and I have a long way to go to a lot of things, but to a healthy body weight, so I figured people know me, and, you know, if not... This is a starting point for me, and it's a continuing point, so I don't have any pictures. I was going to bring my big jeans, but then I held them up in front of me. I was like, they're not really that much. They are, but you know. So, Jenny before has said that how we do this is we start with, I was born in a shack in Mississippi, and then we go from there. But normally we talk about how it was, and then what happened, and what it's like now. So I didn't realize it was going to be like this, but the how it was part was the most difficult for me, because, well, I'm going to read you guys a list of things, and the list is things I used as excuses and circumstances to say in self-pity and reasons to be a victim, and really the conclusion I came to is that we're all the same. So these things have happened to other people. Nothing is new. And I guess just for the sake of people who don't know me, I'm gonna read this. So I haven't ever had a life where I wasn't a compulsive overeater or where I wasn't very, very large and didn't fit in places, like literally fit. And I was about 100 pounds when I was 5, and I was over 200 pounds when I was 10. And I went to my first... It was called Family Weight Loss Center. It was like my first diet center with the dehydrated food when I was 6. Because I begged my mom to go. I called her at work. I was like, Mom, I'm fat, please. It was ridiculous. But, okay, so then I started eating then, I believe. It doesn't really matter. But from when I was 4 to when I was 8, I was sexually abused by someone in my family, and then I was abused again later by another family member, and I started crying a lot. And so, you know, my mom didn't know what to do. She didn't have any coping skills either, so she was like, eat a cookie, it'll make you feel better. And that was kind of my thing from then on. Eat a cookie, I'll feel better. My parents, well, they have addictive personalities. I'll say that about them. And that's all I really need to say about them. I used to blame things on my mother a lot. I'm trying to not do that anymore because I choose my own actions now, and I really need to move on from things that happened like 20 years ago. So, yeah, so I probably saw some examples of people coping with substances, but, you know, now I'm the one who has to decide. So, when I was 11... what is the big year for me? I wrote all this stuff down. I had my first hallucinations. It was the year I told people that I was abused and was just totally ignored. So I also started drinking that year, started smoking, and I started cutting myself, started lying about my age and hanging out with people who were like 18. Bad news. So yeah, that was a big year, and that just basically continued then. That was my life. Through high school I drank. I was kicked out of my high school for drinking, and then I went back. And another thing that I think is just a circumstance that people need to know is that I'm bipolar, and so I spent like a good chunk of time, a number of years, being in hospitals and then out of the hospital and back and forth. And I think that's important because it's the same to me as my disease of compulsive overeating. Like, I have to deal with it every day. I don't get to say I'm done with it one day. It took me a long time to adjust to that, just like it took me a long time to come to OA, I guess. So, yeah, so I did all that stuff to hurt myself. I did starve myself for a time, and I wasn't very good at that, and it didn't work well. Some people, it works, not me. My body needs food, I guess. So I went through a period where I had sex pretty indiscriminately. And like I said, I hurt myself, razor blades, burned myself, those kind of things. And all of that, those kind of things to me, I was just avoiding growing up Like, I didn't know it at the time, but... So, that was what I was doing to avoid facing anything. I didn't know how to be with myself, and I didn't know how to be inside myself, and I just wanted to be distracted. So, when I was 20 years old, I stopped drinking. I was blacking out, and I'd wake up in the morning and vomit, and then I'd have to drink more so that I could be okay. And I stopped when I was 20 because I had some insight, thankfully, that if I didn't quit before it was legal and I could run to the liquor store myself, that I would just die. I knew I would kill myself. So, I don't know if I'm an alcoholic. I mean, you guys are probably like, yes, I'm nodding on the thing. I'm nodding. But for me, it started as a coping thing, and then it became a diet. Like, I didn't drink beer because that has way too many calories. I drank vodka, and then I didn't eat, and vodka curbs my appetite because it makes me vomit. So that is what it is. I don't know. I went away to a boarding school for high school when I was 13, and I weighed about 260 then. And then high school was when I was starving myself. I usually ate twice a week. I ate on a Wednesday and I ate on a Saturday in front of my parents. And those were the times I ate. I was running and lifting weights. I was a power lifter then. I don't know how I did that. I really don't know how I had the energy, but I've always hesitated to say, well, I was anorexic because I didn't get to any weight that I considered satisfying. So I suppose that's what I was. I became really hypoglycemic and fainted a lot until I hit my head one day, and then they took me to the doctor and found out I was hypoglycemic because I wasn't eating. So yeah, over the years since then, I'm 29 now, my weight went up and down, but always up at the end of the year. You know, the New Year's resolutions, it was always higher than the year before. When I stopped drinking, I was around 250, 260, and then I didn't have that to cope, and the food was just the only thing. So then I got up to just right around 500 pounds, 496 I saw on the scale. But so my highest weight in OA was 465 pounds, and now just like last week, I got to the point that I've lost over 100 pounds in OA, and that's important, but I mean, that's the physical recovery part, which is, of course, I want to be healthy, it's great, but I still have a long way to go, and that's not really what I found here. You know, what I found here is that there's a lot of hope, and I guess this part, before I get to the next part, is like, this is where there is a beginning of hope, because I can't imagine now, I was talking to somebody about this the other day, that I'm going to go back. You know, I know relapse happens, I know what happens, but for me to wake up in the morning and start my day with self-injury and continue all of that hurting myself through the day, like I'm not that person anymore, and the only reason I'm not is because of OA and my higher power and all you guys. So I feel like I'm really too happy and I'm too invested in my life to just stop. I mean, I've tried to imagine, like, okay, if I were going to binge, how long would it last? And I can't really think that it would be more than a few days because I just don't know. And I'm really grateful. Like, being at the point where I can say I can't imagine it, that's great. So, so we're always kind of on that ledge. I hear people say that a lot, that we're right above the food. We could dive back in. And I think that is true, and we have to look at this one day at a time. But I think also that I'm standing right now in the present moment, and it doesn't allow me to dwell in my addictive past. So that is my first part. And I'm not going to tell food stories. You guys have heard them, most of you anyway, and some of them are even really funny to most people probably. But I don't know. Like, I don't know how else to communicate to you guys. I don't need to talk about, but I'll just give you one. Like, I crashed my car because I dropped a donut on the ground, and I bent over to pick it up. So that's about how bad it was. Like, I guess all I can say is to all of you, like, imagine what you would have to do to yourself to sustain a weight of 500 pounds. Like, if you can't imagine it, then that's what I did. So that covers that. I came to OA because I was seeing a therapist, and I was seeing a therapist to try to get them to approve me for gastric bypass. And I didn't want to come here. The therapist told me about it and just said, go, be open-minded, and I didn't want anything to do with a God group, as I called it. Because the God I knew didn't approve of me in my life and who I was, and sucked, basically. But I went to a meeting on a Monday night, and I heard somebody talk about when they were young and how they had been with food right from the beginning, and I totally related to that, and so I kept coming back. And that was in January of 2008. I'm looking at my transcripts a lot now because I'm trying to get my bachelor's degree done, finally. And when I started OA, it was January 2008, and I looked at my transcripts the other day, and there are no classes for 2008. And I'm like, what was I doing? You know, like, what the hell was I doing with my life if I wasn't even in school? And I didn't remember that I was gone for a year, but I had been diagnosed with a physical illness that then I had to go to physical therapy like 4 days a week for 6 months or something. So I lost my muscle tone, and I did that, and I came to meetings pretty much. I came to meetings every day, and it was good for me because I got to know kind of the OA community going to every meeting. And there were a couple people at the time that started when I did that came to meetings every day with me, and I'm really grateful to them, especially to one who I call my twin. We started our abstinence on the same day and didn't know it. We found out later, and then she kept me going. You know, I know that we have to do this for ourselves, but I thought, I want to honor that bond I made with her, and so kept me going for the first however many months. So I came to all those meetings, and it took me 9 months of all those meetings to get abstinent or to even make an attempt. I didn't even attempt to try to eat better. Most people have heard about my Mike and Ikes. I always thought, like, if I could get my binge food down to one food, I'd be pretty much fixed, like if it was one thing. So I got it down to Mike and Ikes, and I ate them constantly. And I would come to a meeting, and I would open my console and stick the box of Mike and Ikes in there, and I'd come into the meeting and leave and eat the rest and get more on the way home. So I did that for 9 months, and then somebody suggested that I write a Dear God letter, and thought, well, who am I going to be talking to? But, you know, I like to write stuff. So it was October 13th of 2008 that I started writing these letters every morning, trying to communicate with something that was supposed to help me. And that was my first day abstinent. And at the time, my abstinence was no recreational sugar, which is nothing that's a food for the sake of sugar, whatever, cookies, cakes, if it's made of dough and if it has frosting. And also, at first I had to stop even like Yoplait yogurts because they had too much sugar. Couldn't do those for a while. So that was my abstinence for the first year, but it started that first day that I wrote that letter, and so I kept writing them. I was like, well, whatever, it worked, so I'm going to keep doing it every single day. And I had to really dismiss all of those ideas I had around God and how awful God was, how God punished me, and all that stuff. It's suggested in the OA 12 and 12 that we dismiss our old ideas of God and we come up with an idea that serves us. And I still remember the girl who told me about that at a meeting, and I thought she was just like brilliant because I thought she made it up. But it doesn't. I mean, somebody made it up and put it in the book, so whatever. But I had to make a relationship with a greater power, higher power, whatever you want to call it, that worked because I couldn't do anything like that myself. I couldn't stop eating all that stuff. I went from donuts, Mike and Ike's, Doritos, like nothing with any nutritional value, completely, to eating healthfully. So it wasn't me. So that was how I got abstinent, and I've been really blessed to be open to the idea that's really enlightening to me, that my abstinence has to evolve because my addiction evolves. And we say that food is cunning and baffling and powerful, and it is. And so I've had to change the definition of my abstinence, and I've worked with my sponsor to do it, but I have not relapsed, and so it's worked for me. I can't say enough, like I say hope all the time. I have hope tattooed on me, which I hate the tattoo now, but that was what I got right away. And so I don't know, when I'm talking to sponsees about starting out and what they have to be willing to do, the analogy, I like analogies, the analogy I always use is that if you were in an abusive relationship, like a romantic relationship, and I were your friend, you would have to let me in at some point to get help. Like, otherwise it would just keep going on. And for me anyway, and I think for some of you, the food relationship is a self-abuse relationship, and it's the exact same thing. So you have to start talking to somebody about it, and you have to open up, or it's never going to stop, and people die from this disease all the time. So I also, if there was one thing, like a tipping point, I mean, I had many rock bottoms, many times where I was in a parking lot, and I had just walked into a bakery and said, I would take a list. I don't know if you guys know this trick. I'd take a list, and I'd walk into the bakery, and I'd be all business, right? And I'd be like, okay, so I never said I wanted. I'd be like, I need 6 carrot muffins, and 6 lemon muffins, and 6 of this, and 6 of that, and I'd be like, and I'm in a hurry. You know, like I was taken to my business place, and I was taking home Cheetos and muffins to eat by myself. That was my trick. I did all kinds of things like that, and so I do remember one rock bottom I had was I was in a Hy-Vee parking lot. I had been trying to avoid going and getting a certain food at a place that was basically sugar. And I avoided it for like 5 days. And this was, you know, before I got abstinent. But I avoided it. And then after 5 days, I thought, well, I just went 5 days without those calories. Like, I surely can have them now. So I went and I got my box of sugar. And I was sitting in my car in this parking lot. And it was late. And I realized that I was getting to the end of my box of sugar, and I was still not happy. Like, I've heard people, again, use an analogy that something to the effect of, like, you can stand in front of an ocean of food, like, it could be unlimited, and you could eat it all, and it would never be enough. Like, nothing is ever enough. And that's the point that I came to, that I realized, like, I could eat this crap all day, and I'm still going to be miserable because I'm still going to be me. So, it makes me sad to think about that, but, I mean, thank God that I got sad. You know, I thought when I got to LA I had to be happy, and it's not really as important as learning things. So, the one other thing was that I realized I was never going to have any relationship with anyone that was more intimate than my food relationship, which is really depressing. Like, because I had spent my whole life, like, protecting it and lying about food and just hiding it and hurting myself with it and worshiping it and all these things. And I still have not had a relationship that was that strong. I haven't had a relationship where I love something as much as I loved food, even though I was in a 6-year relationship. Which, okay, so 5 days into my abstinence, that whole food fog we talk about lifted. And so on day 5, I left my partner that I just referred to, and I had been with her for about 6 years then. That got really ugly. Like, I had always thought, well, I'll just keep living with her, we'll be friends. No. Really ugly, really scary, really psychotic, so I had to move out. I broke a lease, and I felt really bad about it, but I stayed with my sister for a month, and I looked for an apartment, and I was super worried because I had never lived by myself. I lived in a dorm with 4 roommates at once all through high school. I lived with roommates after that, and when you live by yourself, who's the person that's watching you? You know, who's the person that's keeping track of your food? Like, you're the only one, so who cares what you eat, you know? Like, I was afraid to move out of my sister's house then because I didn't know what I would do. So I had this little transition where I had a different sponsor for a short time. And, well, this was because I thought my first sponsor that I had, I remember saying to people, she hasn't called me in, like, however long. And just a note, you guys are supposed to call your own sponsors. Like, it's your deal. It's not, they're not going to fix you. Nobody's going to fix you. Doesn't work like that. So anyway, I had this other sponsor for a while because I was disappointed with mine. And that sponsor told me she had once lived in an apartment somewhere, California or something. And when she moved out of the apartment, she was really happy because she could say, I never binged in this apartment. I never, the whole time I lived here, I didn't sit here and binge. And that totally saved my ass. I was like, okay, I'll move into an apartment because that's my goal, you know. I wanted to be able to be healthy for my own sake, not for somebody else, because I, you know, hiding food from someone, who cares? Like, that's the thing, too, is, like, I was wearing it, you know, I'm still wearing it. It wasn't that I was hiding it from anybody, but I didn't get that. So, I hadn't eaten the recreational sugar for a year, but I was getting really what we always refer to as RID, which is restless, irritable, and discontent. I didn't want to cooperate with that new sponsor I got, and so I thought about leaving program, and I thought I was too busy, which is ridiculous, and but I did decide that I needed to come back, and I really just didn't go to meetings for maybe 2 weeks. But I, like, if you don't eat sugar, that's great, and everybody's different. I'm going to say that later. Everybody's different, but after a while, I was like, well, what other non-carb foods can be my new fun, you know? Like, there's got to be other things that are still good, and there are. So so that no sugar thing didn't really work out forever. And so I had to change, and I realized that I needed program, and I came back, and my first sponsor that I had was gracious enough to take me back, and even though I had said to people that she never called and bitched about her. And I think, again, I have to say this because you can't say enough about having a sponsor. People come, and I've heard people say, I came for years and didn't have one. I don't know. Just don't. Like, if anybody, like, just don't do that. Just get a sponsor. And it should be noted, I think, we're all adults, and people are going to change sponsors, and there aren't going to be any hard feelings. And if there are, I'm going to try not to curse too much on this, but, I mean, just, we're adults, so it happens, it has to happen sometimes, because sometimes you're not willing to accept the help from one source, and it has to be a different face or a different approach or something, but, you know, I need a sponsor. So, my abstinence changed, and it was really hard, because I couldn't keep putting things in a box and saying, okay, just none of that. Like, I'm a person of extremes. Major extremes and black and white thinking, and my new sponsor, that I still have, would always stress the importance of being, like, having balance. Like, that's the word I heard all the time, over and over. She drew me this little picture, I still have it, and balance is, like, on top of the seesaw kind of thing, and it's a balance of action and accountability. And I still, now I tell other people that, which is her idea. Probably it's not even hers. Someone wrote it who was brilliant, but I just mean, it's probably in the literature is what I mean. That's all I'm saying. Okay, so, yeah, the all or nothing thing went on my whole life, and that enabled me to keep being an addict too, because, you know, you can't just stop eating, and I did try that, but it didn't work. So, there's a quote that I like about that, and it is really simple. The road of all or nothing most often leads to nowhere. And so my current abstinence baseline definition is at or moving towards a healthy body weight. And for me that works because I need to be there or progressing. When I'm not, I'm lying to myself. And it's not that way for everybody. I know it's different. We have dignity of choice in our program, and that means that whatever works for you, and everybody's going to be happy for you and celebrate it, because we're all different. So, I can't thank my sponsor enough, because she's moderate, and she's calm, and she emphasizes that, and that, you know, I try to work on that too. So, right now my food plan, which is different than the abstinence, but my food plan is basically just moderation. I mean, that sounds really simple, and it's not really simple. It's complicated to be moderate. So there are a lot of other stipulations. I have a lot of things on my food plan, like when I go to a family function or a buffet, I get one plate of food, which is a waste. Don't go to a buffet and get one plate of food. Don't do it. It'll just make you angry. But I do that because, as my sponsor pointed out, who needs more than one plate of food? Like, at a meal? And nobody needs that. And for my family, that helps because we eat all day long on holidays. Like, all day. There's food out. 8 pieces of pie on Thanksgiving, you know. So, yeah, there are a lot of other little things on my food plan, and you can always ask me if you want to know about them, but I won't go on any more about that. Other than addressing the food, I had to do, and I still have to do, a lot of other things to participate in program. And they're all, I have this stuff written in, it's the basic stuff. Like, I have to come to meetings, I have to do the step work, because this is a 12-step program. I read the big book, and I've read the abstinence book, I've read the 12 and 12s, and I keep reading, and I keep finding new things. My sponsor encouraged me to do service, and that's been really important for me. I love doing the newcomers meeting, which I did this morning. There's usually like 1 or 2 people there, but I'm so excited because they're new and they don't know anything and they just listen to me. So it's great. I'm a sponsor, and that is like, I hear people say this, it's really, you learn more from the person you're sponsoring because they're the one that you're like tracking their growth, you know, and you're getting to see it happen. And if I have anything to do with anything that my sponsees do, then I'm really great. That's great. But most of all, it's just watching them grow. So I still, you know, I meet with my sponsor. I use the tools. We have 9 tools. I use journaling a lot and meetings, and I use email a lot. People in this room have got an email from me at 4 in the morning that's really long. That's what I like to do, is write emails because I'm terrible with the phone. So, and also, I've followed a food plan that's right for me, and I don't claim that it's right for anybody else, because it might not be, but that's what I do to maintain my program. I want to say one more time, this last time, that we have dignity of choice. Like, it says it in the pamphlets, I think we first get in the newcomer packet, or used to, and we get to decide what our recovery looks like. I haven't done anything that is spectacular at all. That's where people say there are miracles in program, but there's no magic. I think that's an important distinction. So all I did was I just kept coming back, and I recognized that the steps are the way that you heal. And also, you know, I got a sponsor, and I got in touch with people because I didn't have a great support system. My family is made up of obese people, and they're into it, and that's just how it is, and I have to let go of that. But I came here, and I did one thing differently, I will say, than I have done in the rest of my life, and that was that I told the truth. I didn't lie about food to people in LA. I didn't lie about what I was doing. I mean, I was pretty much a compulsive liar, and I just decided, maybe that's something new. I'll try it. I won't lie, and it worked, so I kept doing it. I also want to say, I have never been in a meeting and said anything that really was like, oh my God, you know, like, addicts aren't easily shocked. I think, you know, we just aren't. So, and that's a really good thing. Because imagine if somebody new came to the meeting and said stuff and everyone just looked around at, you know, they're like side glancing over there, and yeah, it would be bad. So it's nice that I say things and other people say things, and we're all the same, as I said before. So in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, on page 381 in the 6th edition, so if you ever want to look for it, I'm going to quote a little bit. When I first came to AA, OA, I didn't know who I was. My sponsor said, great, if you don't know who you are, you can become whomever God wants you to be. Today I'm doing things I never dreamed possible. And I really like that part of that story. It's from Winner Takes All. And it's come really to be the truth of my life for me. I circled this on my page, God, because I capitalized it. I'm like, I hate when people capitalize God. Oh, but again, see, that's the thing. That's my thing. Everybody has their own thing, and it's fine. But for me, God is the power in the universe that takes care of me. And it ensures that every moment, even now, I'm right where I need to be. And that has proven true every time. Even when I've been in a really hard moment and everything has been horrible, you know, 10 minutes later, or, you know, a couple weeks later, everything is how it should be. So I think that I have been able to reimagine myself because I heard another quote at the first retreat that I went to, and that was that your higher power has greater things in store for you than you could ever imagine. And again, like, this is getting into levels of like, really, there's a person greater than me, there's a thing greater than me. I remember being miserable at my first fall retreat. I don't know if some of you guys remember how miserable I was, but probably not, because nobody cares, right? You guys were in your own egos, but I was pretty miserable, and I thought, you know, I was never going to have any relationships, and I was never going to do anything, and all of this stuff. And the speaker that year had us write letters to ourselves, and she mailed them back a year later. Oh my gosh, that's a good exercise for anybody, by the way, if you want to find out about yourself. Write honestly to yourself and give it to somebody for a year. Mail it. I don't know where you can mail it to me, but I'll give it back to you in a year, and you're going to be like, oh my God. Hopefully, you're going to think that, how did I have that perspective, you know? How have I come so far? Because that's what I thought. I got that letter back, and I thought, who is this totally pathetic, miserable person? And so, yeah, I mean, I've changed a lot in ways that I didn't think were possible. So, yeah, when I started, I wasn't doing anything. And I came to meetings because I didn't have a job. I didn't go to school. I didn't have a church. I didn't have anything like that. I still don't. But, I mean, I wasn't involved in anything. I wasn't participating in my life is the main point. And, you know, I don't... Right now, I'm doing things. You know, I'm finishing my undergraduate degree, and I'm writing a thesis, and then I'm going to go to graduate school. And I wanted to do that and teach since I was 5. You know, when I learned to read, I said, I want to teach people to do that. But I didn't believe it my entire life. I thought it was some dream that I was never going to have because I wasn't good enough. And I still kind of have a capability problem sometimes, which is a problem, but we also have a phrase, act as if, and so I try hard to act as if I am capable of doing that. If, you know, so funny to think of. Someday I'm going to be Professor Emily, hopefully, and that's really funny, so I like that. I didn't keep any promises to myself. This is another thing that I like to talk about with sponsees, that it's so much easier for addicts, I think, and for me, it was so much easier to keep promises to other people. Like, I'm always early. I'm perpetually early, as many of you know. So if I tell you I'm going to be somewhere at 6, I'm going to be there at probably 5:30, and if I tell you in June I'm going to be there, I'll be there at 5:30 in June on the day I told you. But I couldn't stick to a food plan or a diet, or I couldn't do any of that stuff because it was a matter of being honorable with myself, and I didn't care about myself. So it was really demoralizing. We used that word. And all my eating, I see now, it wasn't like, this is a party. I mean, it was. If there was a party, I would eat. But it was all self-punishment. Like, that's all it was. And sometimes I was even aware. You know, like, I knew I'm doing this because I just embarrassed myself. Now I'm going to go eat. And I'm going to get bigger and bigger, and there's going to be a bigger layer between me and the world. And I just thought it was helping me. You know, I thought that was what I needed, but it wasn't. So I'm not in a place of perfect serenity. I don't think that exists. But I can work with my higher power now, and I can calm my addict mind down enough to get some things done. Sometimes I can't. I'm learning to do that, to get more quiet. Oh, okay, this is my favorite quote. And you guys hear me beat this to death all the time. It's from the For Today book, the meditation book from May 15th. And it's a Russian proverb, and it is, pray to God, but continue to row to shore. When I read that, it just opened everything up for me. Because I didn't understand, like, okay, so I believe in this big power up in the sky, and it's going to do everything for me. No. Like, the idea is that God, whatever you want to call it, God does for us what we can't do. And we still have to do all of the stuff that we're capable of doing. And it's a responsibility issue, and I didn't like to be responsible, and I still don't really like to be responsible, but it's enough for me now that I have enough reward that I'm willing to do it. I'm willing to stick to a food plan and do all those daily things. Most of the time, I send my food to someone at night. Different people have been the recipient of those food emails, and I'm grateful to all of them because it was usually food, you know, breakfast, lunch, dinner, and then I would get rambling about something. And I think people sometimes feel obligated to write back, just so you guys know. It's not really necessary. I mean, I talk to myself a lot, so. Wow, I talked about that rock bottom moment of sitting in that grocery store parking lot, and I would say that was pretty bad. Also, I don't know, it was really pivotal one day. We had a meeting at the library, and it was the only time we had it there. I don't remember why. We couldn't use the church or something, but after the meeting, I must have been talking about my mother, because I did that all the time, because my mother was the problem, because she's fat. And so anyway, after the meeting, my sponsor asked me, really gently she asked me, but she said, what would change if my mother apologized to me for making me fat? Like, what would happen, you know? Like, would I suddenly be different? Would I change? Would it fix everything, and would I let go of the resentment? And it didn't matter. Like, it wouldn't matter. I mean, I've never gotten that from my mother, but why would I? Like, I think I've learned finally that everybody does the best that they can do. And sometimes, with our parents or with other people, it's not good enough for us. And that's just the truth of it. But then many times, I'm sure my best has not been good enough for other people, too, so. I mean, what are you going to do? It's just how it is. Overall, it was like it was a victim thing. Like, I played that role my whole life. I remember the first therapist that said I was a victim of sexual abuse. I was like, oh. Like, not that that was a good thing, but I was like, victim, that's a good word. You know, I'll just cling on to that. And I just wanted to be dismissed from having to take responsibility for my life. And if you have any kind of a life that you enjoy, you don't want to be dismissed from it. You want to live it. So, I have written down here, self-hatred. Talk about that. I spent my whole life basically, thinking that I was like, I'm stuck in this body, and I'm betrayed by my body, and burdened, and all of those things, and I hated my body, and I hated my face. When I was about 14, I was trying to convince my mom to let me get a nose job and to get collagen injections in my lips. I went on about it and on about it and almost had her convinced, because that was just how my mom was. She was that kind of a person who was like, okay. I'm glad I didn't. I have the family nose. Like, it's my nose. It's a dramatic nose that I have, but I still kind of want the collagen injections. I'm going to admit that on tape. Okay, so this past year at the fall retreat, the speaker said something that really affected me, and we got to the room where the thing was, and she had like an easel with this big footboard of paper, and I actually have the thing. It's in my car, of course. I forgot to bring it in, but the paper said in like big markers, it said that I used to think I was a body that had a soul. And I know now I'm a soul that lives in a body. And I got so, my whole life just got hung up on like this. My body is never going to be what I want it to be. And I thought I would never look normal, whatever that is. I thought I wouldn't look normal even if I lost weight, because I thought, you know, I've put myself in a place of basically permanent disfigurement. You know, I'm going to have extra skin, I'm going to have this or that. And it's like the silliest, most classy excuse that I've heard people use and me use. I don't want to lose weight because I'll have all the extra skin. You have it now, it's just full of fat. Like, what is the difference? So, whatever. But that was one of my things. But that, all of that is like, I thought I was a body on display for people, you know? And I struggle with that some still, but I didn't pay any attention to my soul, and that's the part that was killing me. And people also have talked, I've heard the phrase, you know, we have a God-sized hole in us that we're trying to fill with food, and the food is never going to do it. You know, I mean, I am really vain, and I have a big ego, and I am shallow. I think that other people are going to be shallow because I am. I go into new situations, and I expect other people to reject me and say, well, you're fat, you're ugly, whatever. And that's my projection onto them. You know, I don't give people a chance when I meet them, because I think everybody must be as shallow as me, and thank God that they're not. That would be awful. Yeah, but so I got really engaged in the silly distraction of my body, and I didn't attend to my soul at all. Like, I didn't take care of my body, and the neglect, though, I think neglect is the right word, that I neglected my soul and my spirit and all of that, and that was a lot more cruel than anything I was even doing to my body. I didn't think that my humanity was anything worth mentioning, and I didn't think, I remember being in a group, a therapy group once, and they said, okay, we're going to go around the room and we're going to list three good things about ourselves. And I actually ran out of the room and didn't do it, which is really dramatic. But I did. I was like, I can't think of three good things. And then they did it the next day, and they made it like a practice. I'm going to have to stay one of these times. And so first they let someone else, like I had this nice friend in the hospital, and they said, okay, well, you can have somebody else say your three nice things. Like, you can have somebody else do it for you today. And that helped, because then I just repeated those things over and over. But, I mean, really, like, how can you not, like, if you're going to go to a job interview, say, you have to be able to talk about yourself in a respectful way, a way that shows you're an appropriate person, you're a capable person. And I just couldn't do that before. I'm working on it. I'm not saying I'm really there, but I'm trying to treat my body kindly now. And it's hard because I don't think that that's what I deserve. But I learned from somebody that word deserve is a really silly word. Like, if we all got what we deserve in Emily Land, you know, we would all be living in a castle or something. And people don't get what they deserve, you know. Bad shit happens to everybody. And the most freeing thing for me is to just realize that bad shit happens to everybody, end of sentence, you know. There's no explaining it, it just happens, and then we have to go on. And if you don't go on, you get stuck and eventually you die. So now I think I can have pretty, I think, healthy friendships that I have, and somewhat healthy romantic relationships. That's a new thing. It scares me to death. But the most really relevant thing for my recovery that I think helps all of us is, it's from the Big Book also. It's page 417. And it's just that it's a part about acceptance. And it says, acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. So, I don't get to choose what part of me I accept, you know? I don't get to say, well, okay, so your eyes are okay because you put on some makeup today, you know? And that's as far as I got for a long time, was saying that. And I have to look over all of this, and I have to tend to it, and I have to be kind, and I have to be respectful. That's one thing. I don't know where my head was exactly in those moments when I was doing things like cutting myself, but I know it wasn't it wasn't a respectful thing. I mean, I didn't respect my body at all to do that to it. Somebody told me when I was talking about my food addiction, and I hadn't been cutting anymore, that they said, you know, it's really at this point worse for you to eat the donut than to cut yourself. And I thought, what? You know, like, because self-injury is the dramatic thing, and she's like, well, you're hurting yourself with the donuts much more. I mean, you're going to die. So, I think that's really most of it. Acceptance is the answer to everything, and for me, I am really grateful that I can come to a meeting any day of the week, that you guys are always here, that you guys always support me, and again, I mean, I've never said anything that people thought was some new thing, you know? So, I mean, anybody, I don't know who's going to listen to this tape at all. If somebody listens to this tape and they think that they're going to come and be shocking, you know, be the shocking thing nobody's heard, it's not going to happen. Sorry. I did come to OA with a really kind of really big chip on my shoulder because I was the biggest person in the room. And when you're at the fat club and you're the biggest person in the room, not a good deal. But it doesn't matter. Like, they know now, like, it doesn't make any difference because I have met people who are of average body weight who are completely miserable. And I mean, I can't always totally relate, but I know that I know it because they tell me. So, I have a lot of gratitude. And I try to write my gratitude list also. That's another thing I haven't mentioned. But someone told me about this list that a lot of OA people were on it. Every day they would type up a gratitude list and email it to each other. And that has been a really sustaining thing in my recovery. I somehow got to be like the master list person. I don't know how that happened. But like, I have the big email list, and I don't get to write it every day now because if I'm doing something, but I'm always in my car talking it out, you know, 10 things or whatever. I don't go overboard anymore because my sponsor told me that writing a list of like 25 things was kind of just like showing off. So I stick to about 10 things, but I make them long. And, 10 paragraphs. So, I have all this stuff. And I think, I think I've said everything I really want to say. I have no idea what time it is. But, I'm so happy you guys are here. Like, I did come to one OA meeting before 2008. It was in 1988. About something like that. And I came to a meeting, and we don't give chips all that often, but sometimes we do, like if you've made a landmark a year or whatever. In the meeting I came to, there was a man there who was bigger than me, and he was getting a 5-year chip. I was like, this is such bullshit, you know? I was like, what? I mean, I wanted to go to a place, and I wanted to walk into the room, and everybody be like a Barbie doll, because that's what I wanted, you know? I wanted to be a Barbie doll. Pretty much, exactly, except, oh my god, except with nipples. So, that's weird, you guys, that's weird. So anyway, I came to that first meeting and I never came back. Like, I wasted that time, you know, because I came and I was like, this person's so fat, what do they have to offer me? And, you know, I found out later who that person was, and that person is wonderful, and the same thing could be said of me today. You know, somebody could walk in right now and be like, why are they recording that person, you know? But, like, we start where we are. Like, that's the only thing you can do. And that idea that when the student is ready, the teacher appears. And that's been true in my life. I've been really, really lucky to have a lot of really good teachers, both literal and just teachers, people who have showed me things. And I hear things at meetings that I think, this person should write a philosophy book, you know? Like, who is this person? But I get to be in the rooms with that, and I'm really happy. So I'm glad for that, and I'm glad that I got to do this because I had to take a break from my homework and sit and think about this stuff. And so I think that's all I have to say. Thanks. Yes, questions. Any other questions? Oh my God. Any questions? No. I'm going to be a teacher someday, you guys, so if I'm going to be faced with this all the time, no questions. Yeah. Anybody?
I have a question. When you first got out of the sugar fog and you split with your partner, how did you then, what did you do to cope with kind of the loneliness, or what did you do differently that kept you kind of clean and so forth?
I guess what I did differently was I thought about myself, like I said, it was only the fifth day that I hadn't eaten sugar, and so that really seemed like, what did you get out of 5 days, you know? But, I mean, since it took me 9 months to get there, I had picked up some things, some knowledge from people, that's nice, and I think at first it was hard because the person I was with actually tried to, well, whatever, she overdosed, and I was still living in the house, and that was why I moved out, so I took on a lot of guilt because of that, but I had to, again, let go of that, and I think the thing is that act as if thing. That's all I did, you know, because I didn't know what to do. I had been so codependent with her for so many years and blamed it all on her, of course. It's like I was in an abusive relationship, which it kind of was, but I mean, I was participating in it, so I did. I guess I just pretended at first, and if you pretend long enough, you change. Hopefully. So. Anybody else? Question? No. Okay. I don't know. Are we done? Oh, okay.
Will you talk a little bit about like what step work looks like in your life? And I can only assume that you write it. But
yeah, I do write it.
Can I talk about how you do it, when you like that kind of thing, what your process is?
Okay. I started out doing step work with we have a 12 and 12 workbook. You know, just to ask questions that go with the 12 and 12, the 12 steps and 12 traditions, and I started doing that, and that was when I had my interim sponsor that I had for a while, and when I look back at that now, I did like steps 1 through 3 in there, and then I did step 4, the big book way, if people have seen the sheets, there's all those callings, and it's like what I resent someone for, and what my part is, and how it's affecting my life, and all that. When I look back at the first time I did the steps, I was still blaming it on everybody else. Like, my first big book, 4-step, was 39 pages, and there were 12 items on each page. I mean, everything was on there. Most of it came down to, you know, I hate myself, I resent everybody else for it. It doesn't make any sense, but it was like 40 pages. My sponsor was just like, oh my God, I have to listen to all this. So, I did that, but then after I started over, the sponsor that I have now, I do write everything out, and I guess what I try to do is think, like, what do I need to do in my life right now, I guess I could say, because I've been through the 12 steps now, I've been through a couple times, and I've done, you know, a number of 4th steps, and the 4th step is the inventory that we take of our actions and things, and right now, it's more, because some time has went by, it's been, you know, 2.5 years, that I guess I try to do whatever I need at the time, and my sponsor helps me with that. Like, if I need to do, maybe think about step 6 and 7, about my character defects, then I need to work on that. And I just address it kind of as it comes along, and I try to do the daily 10th step on my own, but I pretty much do things how they are in the book, and I try to do it that way, so... That's my answer to that. You're like, God, stop talking so much.
Can you share a little bit about how you got to the point of, I assume, deciding against the gastric bypass and what was going on, kind of how you got to that?
Oh, yeah. I didn't really come to that myself. They turned me down. That was the only reason I didn't have it. I mean, it's a tool that people use, just like a diet is a tool that people try, I believe, anyway. It's an outside issue, but I tried for like 3 years to have the surgery. Now I think like 3 years I could have been losing all this weight if I wasn't like having all these last suppers at restaurants because I was never going to get to eat there again. But yeah, my insurance said no. They said I wasn't sick enough. And it was kind of ironic because I was pretty sick, but I don't know. I think about that still because I think, what if, you know, would things have happened differently for me, worse, better, I don't know. But I'm glad that, you know, I was in the process of it because, it, you know, like I said, the universe keeps unfolding and it got me to the therapist who got me here. So I'm really happy that I had that idea, which came from the day I stepped on the scale and it was 496 pounds, so...
I don't have a question, but I would like to say that, you know, I loved your part about acceptance, and you know, I was sitting here watching you, and you're like a champagne bottle of self-acceptance, you know, you didn't battle the crap out of yourself, you didn't, you know, you, I mean, you could have taken the Navy Road, but I mean, you've just given me so much, just... Feel warm, you know. You just—it was very nice, man. You didn't come here and share the crap and say, you know, it's just this. And you just do that, you know. You talk about those dreams, you know. We believe, we begin, we become, and that's real radiant, and that's and it shows. And I want to give you kudos for that. That's awesome.
Thank you. Additional questions we have sharing now? Can we stop this? Oh, okay.
But wait, there's more. Certainly in your life, people have failed you and hurt you. What role has forgiveness played, or has it played a role in your recovery?
Okay, forgiveness has played a role in my recovery. When you get to doing the step work with your resentments, and then you write a list of who you need to make an amends to, and then you make amends to people. And that's a big deal, you know, I mean, I try to point that out to people I sponsor, like, do you know how many people in their life look at their whole life and go back over it and make amends? No, people don't do that. But really, I got stuck with that step because I didn't know how to forgive myself, like with my food stuff. Yeah, maybe people have failed me in my life, but I guess my view on that is that a whole thing about everybody rises to the occasion as much as they can, you know. They don't know any better, or they would do better. So that's kind of how it was with others. But with me, it was hard, because I had to think of living amends to make to myself. Like, how am I really honestly going to keep treating myself better so that, you know, I don't go backwards or whatever, you know. And that, I got, sponsor is nodding. I was stuck on that for quite a long time, because I couldn't get my head around it. I couldn't think of anything. I just thought that I didn't deserve to be forgiven, you know, because there were all kinds of things I said. I'm permanently damaged, and my body is a mess, and I'm never going to be this, and I'm never going to be that. And so I think that one thing that people say is, you know, you forgive people for you, not for them. That helped me a lot, so.
What are your biggest hopes?
Really, it's still hard for me to say, even though I even said it in here, that I really, really want to, as far as the external crap, you know, I want to be a professor, I want to have that in front of my name. But what I really want for myself is that I'm kind to myself, you know, that it's a pattern, you know, it's not a new thing I'm trying out, that it's like, I can actually achieve that where I'm kind to myself and I treat myself with dignity. And I think it's going to take constant work. You know, I don't think that I'm just going to, like, I'm done now. Because especially now, it's like, I'm going to walk out of here and have these papers shuffled and all that, and I'm just done. I'm not. It's going to be, like, my whole life. But what I hope is that that I'm that person someday that I, you know, that I always wanted to be. And it, really, the thing about it is that I have to realize that I am now. It's that acceptance thing again, you know? Like, I am right now who I should be. And that, like, I hope I can grow to more acceptance of it. I am all blotchy. I thought I would be nervous. Okay. That's the end.
Thank you.